Someday soon you will see by the light of day that someday soon all your worries will fade away.
That, of course, is the beautiful voice of classic rock legend Graham Nash, who is here in St. Louis to work with his buddies David Crosby and Steve Stills and Neil Young on the finale of the CSN Y2K tour. And Graham joins me live on the phone again now. Hi, Graham. How are you?
Paul, it's good to hear you again.
It's good to hear you. Last time we talked was just before the tour was kicking off.
And
right. You were waiting for your legs to fully heal, and you said, I'll be ready for the tour. Don't worry about me.
I'm ready. We have one more show to go, and I'm doing fine.
Good, good. I'm glad to hear that. The road been good to you this time?
It's been amazing. It has been a truly amazing experience. To watch this kind of music being created each night, differently each night, in front of me has been an amazing experience as a musician.
Now, when you're up there on stage, you're not doing the same set every night, so how are you deciding that? In fact, I went to the web and looked at some of the set lists that are posted on your website, and I noticed that there are nice changes each night. How are you deciding that?
Depends how we feel. Depends how, you know, if one night Davey wants to do 8 Miles High or Long Time Gone, that's what we'll do. If Neil wants to do Helpless or Only Love Can Break Your Heart or Old Man or you know, Mr. Soul, it's whatever we feel like doing right then.
Do you do that before you go on stage?
Oh, no. That would be way too confusing. why don't we wait for the instant that it happens and confuse everybody?
Are there times where somebody starts playing something and you look around and you go, I thought we were doing Helpless. What are you doing?
Several times.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And the funny thing is to see the faces on our guitar roadies when we say, now, go get a different guitar. We're doing this.
Yeah.
I've never seen people run so fast.
You know, the song I used when we were starting here is from the new album by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young called Looking Forward, which came out last fall.
Yep.
And the song was called Someday Soon.
Yes.
And the lyric is, someday soon you'll see by the light of day that someday soon all your worries will fade away. Keep holding on to the love that's made you strong, and someday soon heartache will all be gone. What are you talking about, Graham?
Here's what happened. We found out during the making of the actual record, before Someday Soon was written, that a friend of a family friend had a daughter who was 14 years old, and she was dying of leukemia. Mm. And she was a big CSNY fan. And so my wife, God bless her cotton socks, decides to take it upon themselves to make her days happier. So we designated her the world's number one CSNY groupie, even though she was only 14. And my wife Susan came down to the studio and took pictures of all four of us holding this sign, had them printed up big, pasted them to a large board, had us all sign it, making Julia the world's number one CSNY groupie. And we sent it off to the hospital, and according to her mother and father, whom I've gotten to know since the incident, made the last 2 weeks of her life incredibly special, because everyone that was handling her was of our age, kind of, and absolutely was over the moon that, you know, a band like us would take the time to get involved in the life of a young girl somewhere in the middle of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 weeks later, Julia died. And on that day, I was in Hawaii. And I wrote Someday Soon as a letter to Jeff and Mary, who were Julia's parents.
Mm-hmm. It is a beautiful song. And I could hear the sentiment in it, but I didn't know the story, and I'm glad you told us about it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
When you have a song that it comes from the heart like that, and you play it for the other guys, what do they then add to it? I mean, it's obviously a very personal song and something that means a lot to you, and you want it to mean a lot to them. Do they then add to it, or do they say, that's beautiful, let's just do it?
We have what we call the reality rule. And the reality rule goes like this. If I sit down and play a song for Neil and it's, you know, not particularly inspiring to him, he'll move on. And it's the same with any of us. If Stephen plays me something that I don't think is particularly great, we don't say anything. However, majority of cases is that we will sit down and sing, I'll sing Someday Soon for Neil. He was almost in tears because I explained to him why I'd written it after I'd sung in the song. Mm. Because the song has to live outside the emotion with which it was written. The art of a good songwriter, I believe, is to take a small incident, not that the death of a 14-year-old girl was a small incident, but to take an incident that is personal to me and make it, through the lyrics and the melody, accessible to every single person in different situations. If you did not know that I had written Someday Soon for, you know, Julia, you would still, I believe, love the song. So it has to stand and have a life and a reason for being on its own, regardless of the reason that it was written. And I think that with a song like Someday Soon, and especially the way it goes down when we play it live, there's no denying it. There's something about it, you know.
And when they hear it and they understand it, then do you...
It then becomes a part of their soul.
Then do you go into a studio and just wing it, or...
Well, this is what happened with this particular song. I written this song after we finished the record. I'm mastering the record in Los Angeles. Neil calls me and he goes, "Hey, Willie, me and Stephen are up here at the ranch. We're not quite sure that we've got all the record. Do you have any other songs?" And I said, "Well, strangely enough, I just wrote a very simple, very beautiful love song to someone's parents." And he said, "Let me hear it." So I played it for him. We walked straight into Neil's studio and cut it in 3 takes.
Wow. Wow. I notice on the record here, you actually, on many of the songs, write down, this was take 5, this was
right.
take 3, this was take 17.
Right.
On a couple, I notice Neil's songs, by the way, take more takes than anybody else's.
I have never known Neil Young to take 17 attempts at anything.
Really?
Neil is very much an immediate man. You know, and if it's not there in 2 or 3 takes, then he'll leave it and go back the next day.
Oh, because there's a song, Out of Control, it says take 17.
I know, I realize that. But when you listen to Out of Control, it has every single note and bar has to be perfectly locked in place. It can't drift from rhythm. It can't break the mood that he's creating. And I'm sure, you know, with a brand new song, because Neil likes to record a song the moment it's written, not tomorrow, the moment it's written. And sometimes you'll come back and you go, you know, I could have said that a little better, therefore let's do another one.
Who arranges the harmonies?
We all do. It's a very instinctive thing with us. You know, whoever it is writes the song generally takes the melody. And then, you know, David and Stephen and Neil sit there and go, "Boy, wouldn't it be cool if..." And they sing ideas. And I go, "Wow, that really sounded great then. What was that?" And he goes, "Well, let's just explore that a little further." Mm-hmm. It's all completely instinctual. None of us write music. None of us care to.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was a Joni Mitchell special on
I saw it.
On TNT. Wasn't that wonderful?
I believe it was a great thrill for Joni to have been honored by her peers like that.
Yeah. You and the whole group obviously have a history with her. How did you guys meet Joni?
I met Joni in... Canada in 1966. She was a friend of David's, and David had told her that if ever the Hollies, which was my band then, were in the neighborhood, that I should go down and meet his friend Graham Nash.
Mm-hmm.
The Hollies were being given an after-show party by the local promoter. There was a long table full of, you know, Cokes and beers and, you know, munchies and stuff. I walk into the room. My manager comes over and starts to talk to me in my ear. I'm not taking any notice of him whatsoever. My eyes are on a beautiful woman who is sitting down in the corner of the room.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Not now, not now, not now. I'm looking at this woman, not now." He said, "Well, if you just shut up a minute, I'm telling you that I know who it is and why she's here." So he said, "Her name is Joni Mitchell. She's a friend of your friend David's, and David thought that you two should meet."
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in love with Joan ever since.
Yeah. She certainly has written some beautiful stuff. And, of course, Woodstock was written by her from the experience that you guys told her, which you then recorded.
I don't believe that's true.
Oh, really?
I believe we helped, yeah. You got to understand, Joni is a wonderfully gifted writer. the majority of Woodstock was written by the time we got to the hotel. I think that our raving to her about what happened just may have helped to maybe finish it and tidy it up.
Oh.
But I do believe that the majority of Woodstock was written before we got to Joan in the hotel, because Joni was my girlfriend at the time,
mm-hmm.
and she was supposed to do the Dick Cavett show, which at the time, you might remember, was kind of an important television show.
Yes.
And Elliot, who manages us and Joni at the time, and still does to a certain extent now on this tour, didn't feel that Joni should go to Woodstock because the reports coming out were that, you know, 20,000 people were going, 50,000 people were going, 100,000 people going, 500,000 people going. And Elliot said, "You'll never get out of there. I can't blow the Dick Cavett show. I don't suggest that you go." So while the four of us went to Woodstock, Joni sat in the hotel in New York City and watched it on, of course, all the media, most channels, because it was, as you remember, quite a happening.
Yes.
And so I truly believe that she'd gotten the majority of the song down. The song was born by the time we got back to the hotel. I think we just put clothes on it.
Gotcha. Well, it certainly worked. However it came to be, it certainly worked. But I'm glad to know that the myth of all these years is not the fact.
It would be very easy and very nice for us to say, "Oh, yeah, Joni wrote that because we you know, enthused about the show and stuff like that." It's not the truth. The truth is that the song had already been born.
This is the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris talking with Graham Nash. Let me go back even further than we've been talking, Graham, to your boyhood in England. When you were growing up and first hearing rock and roll,
yes.
and getting interested in that,
yes.
what were you listening to?
My musical influences were quite strange. You know, I was very turned on by pop music. I liked the hit records of the time, The Ballad of Davy Crockett, This Old House, you know, Wheel of Fortune by Teresa Brewer, all those kind of things. Then the boy stars started to get into it, Bobby Rydell and stuff, and I just couldn't, you know, they were cute, but I couldn't deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then on a Sunday evening at around 8 or 9 o'clock at night, from Radio Luxembourg, in Luxembourg, in Europe, was beamed the American Top 40 show. Now, on a Sunday evening, I'm supposed to be in bed because I'm going to school the next day, but there's no way I'm not listening to the show. We only had one radio at home. Fortunately, it was directly in the room below my bed. So if my parents turned the radio on, which they did, I could hear it through my bedpost.
Mm.
I would have my ear to my bedpost. I spent several hours with my ear to this bedpost listening to the music. Then it was Little Richard and Elvis and the Everly Brothers and Buddy Holly and Gene Vincent and Jerry Lee Lewis and the Platters and Fats Domino. You know, that was the music that turned my life on fire.
And when did you start hearing songs that had a social conscience, which would become a big part of what you and your pals have done with music for so many years?
That was an interesting question. I've been thinking about, and the normal standard answer is, of course, when I met Crosby and started smoking dope. But the actual truth is, I remember several songs recorded by the Hollies that were of social relevance. Certainly one of them called Too Many People, in which I talk about the fact that there's just too many rats in this cage.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess somewhere around 65.
And when do you remember when you put your first band together?
Yes, I do. That was the end of 1960.
Mm-hmm.
Because me and Alan Clark, who later formed the Hollies, had been singing as a duo since we were 14. And when in 14, that was 1956.
Mm-hmm. And so you'd been singing as a duo, and then a few years later you put together a band. And
yeah, this guy comes up and he says, "You need a band." I says, "Why do we need a band? We're fine here. We play two acoustic guitars. We get a lot of money. We don't have to split it with anybody, and we can do what the fuck we want." He said, No. You listen to the new music, man. You need a drums and a bass and a guitar player, and I know the perfect three." He happened to be the drummer. He said, "I know the perfect three." And so we formed a band in late 60.
And what would you play?
We'd play American rock and roll music. We'd play Benny Spellman. We'd play Arthur Alexander. We'd play The Miracles. We'd play The Shirelles. We'd play Roy Orbison. We'd play Buddy Holly songs. We'd play American Top 40.
And now here you are 40 years later, still strapping on the guitar, still sitting down at the piano, and coming to the Kiel Center tonight. And then What happens next for Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young? Do you scatter to the winds as you've done so many times before?
We will indeed scatter to the winds. We have talked in generality about the future. One of the mistakes that we made as a band is pre-committing too early to long, grueling tours and hating the space in between. I don't want to commit to doing a tour next year. Who the hell knows where we're going to be? Right?
Right.
But there will be a point at which there's a point at which you have to make a decision if you're going to book a tour. You know, you need 6 months lead time, kind
sure.
of.
Yeah.
And at one point, we'll all get on the phone, or we'll all go up to Neil's ranch, or he'll come down to L.A., and we'll sit down and talk about what it is we want to do. It's been such a fantastic experience. I would truly want to believe that we want to do this again.
So this will not be the last CSNY tour.
I do not believe so. I think that our general plan right now is to take the summer off, go back into the studio in September, work on the live record and the live video that we've been shooting every single night of this tour, put that out for Christmas, go into the studio, record another studio album, bring it out, do the same thing again, and go to Europe.
Now, is Neil allowing himself to be filmed this time around with you guys?
Yes, he is.
Because when you were talking about
Woodstock, I know.
Just for my audience, when he was talking about Woodstock before, he said the four of us would be there, and anybody who's seen the movie only sees the three.
That's right.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash, because Neil refused to be videotaped or photographed at the time.
That's right.
But this time around, he's actually going to be in there, and we'll see the whole thing.
Bigger than life.
Do you listen to your music on classic rock radio, Graham?
No.
Too many times you've heard them over and over again?
No, I'm more interested in what I'm writing now. You know, I don't care about what we did. That, you know, that's for other people to care about.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the album says, we're looking forward. I mean, I'm in the car and it comes on. How can I avoid listening to it? Do I search it out? Do I play my own records? Absolutely not.
That would be kind of weird. You go home tonight and think, you know what? I'd like to hear Wind on the Water.
No.
No, not going to happen.
No.
But, of course, you're still doing old stuff in concert. And I hear, by the way, that the concert is a massive concert. You guys are on stage for close to 3 hours, right?
Oh, way over 3 hours.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
The average length of the show has been about 3 hours, 25 minutes.
Wow. So anybody
That's why my voice is a little rough right now.
Yeah, yeah. How's it holding up, by the way?
Phenomenally so. I have by far the most difficult part of the band because, you know, we're so identified with the harmonies, and normally in any harmonic stack, it's usually the high guy that sticks out, and that's my voice.
Right.
But I'm 58 years old, Paul. Can you do the same things you did when you were 20?
I couldn't do what you do now when I was 20.
But I'm managing rather well, I believe.
And how about Stephen, who was complaining about his voice last fall, last time we talked?
Stephen's voice has changed over the years. You know, it's gotten a little bluesy, a little growlier, but he's doing his best. I've been very proud of Stephen on this tour.
How's the crowd responding to the new stuff? Because I know this is a classic problem when people are performing in concert. They come and they want to hear Sweet Judy Blue Eyes and Woodstock and 49 Bye-Byes.
It would be easy to say that the new stuff goes over equally as well as the old stuff. It does not, because there's no built-in longing to hear Our House.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so at the beginning, when I start to play Our House, the place goes crazy.
And they sing for you, don't they?
Oh, they do indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
And they go crazy at the end. The new stuff goes down incredibly respectfully. It goes down well, but it doesn't have that 30-year built-in, you know, anxiety.
Yeah, I guess it can't.
But it goes down phenomenally well, so much so that we do 9 things from the new record.
That gives you an idea how big the set is tonight when they're throwing in 9 things from the new record and getting a lot of the old classic stuff in a three-and-a-half-hour show.
We do about 33 songs.
33 songs when you go tonight. And, you know, we've talked about Neil, we've talked about Stephen. How's David holding up? I mean, here's a guy who you have been on a roller coaster with for, 30-plus years.
As has the rest of the world.
Yeah, you know, the drugs, the jail, the Melissa and Julie story that came out a couple months ago. Were you surprised by that, by the way?
No, of course not. I'd known all along.
So you didn't have to run out and get Rolling Stone to see the story.
No. I'm one of David's best friends.
I know, and it's been that way for a long time.
Right.
But you were never asked to father a child for a lesbian couple.
No, but it would be a thrill if I was asked to father a child by a lesbian couple. I'd consider it immediately.
Well, there you go. If you're at the show tonight, just pass your note to the front, and Graham will be happy to talk to you about that. It's always a pleasure talking to you, Graham. Next time you guys get back together and want to head back on the road, I hope we have another chance to talk.
I'm sure we will, Paul.
Thank you again, Graham.
You're more than welcome, Paul.
Good to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Graham Nash, classic rock legend, in his only broadcast interview.